Senate Finance meeting will come to order. Today is April 15th. If you haven't done your taxes, you have a few hours left. It is 8 minutes after nine. Today I'm joined by my co-chairman, Senator Stedman, Senator Ellis, Senator Thomas, and Senator Huggins. Having Senator Olson coming shortly. We're going to have a split meeting today. I'm going to chair the meeting for the first piece of legislation, which is the supplemental budget, House Bill 113. We also have on our calendar House Bill 199, appropriations for the non-transportation stimulus, the House Bill 134, the cruise ship wastewater discharge permits, and House Bill 26 for Medicaid to adult dental services. So we have a full slate of House bills that we're going to be addressing, but this morning I wanted to have David Teal, the legislative director, come to the table and walk us through the supplemental as it has come over to us from the House. Mr. Teal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I am David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance. And in front of you, you should have a spreadsheet dated April 9th, 2009. And rather than trying to walk through the bill, as we've discussed, we'll just walk through the spreadsheet, not line item by line item, because it's a 48-page spreadsheet, but just to give you an idea of what's in that bill. And I should start by saying that there are no legislative items in this bill. Everything was submitted by the governor, and of course not everything went in, most of it did. And just to summarize the cost of the bill, you'll see some the box in the upper right-hand corner of page one. And you'll see that the operating portion of the supplemental, general funds are down $59 million. Federal funds are up $53.6 million. And again, that reflects, to a large extent, the substitution of federal Medicaid match, the FMAP, for general funds in the health and social services budget. And then other funds are down seven. So it's a net reduction of a little over $12 million in the bill and for operating items. Then there are some capital items as well. That's an addition of $3.3 million general funds and again some federal and other funds as well. So just to the left of that box, there's some numbers that give you a net. And we're repeating the $59 million in operating reductions. Then there are unallocated reductions of $11.6 million. That we'll discuss in a moment were not included in the bill but still are savings. And that gives you a total reduction of $70.7 million, and then with capital of just over $3.2 million, you end up with a net reduction of general funds here of $67.5 million. And the process we used for producing this bill was that House and Senate staff, four co-chair staff and a few other members of both House, I think mostly House, met, agreed on what we could agree on with agency review if necessary, then took the whole package to the co-chairs. The co-chairs reviewed the staff choices and made some final decisions that the staff couldn't make. And the whole thing ended up being a color-coded spreadsheet that's in front of you. The green items mean that it's in the bill. Orange items are out of the bill. For those without a colored version of this, I think the green print's in a much darker shade and the orange is a lighter shade. So again, Orange was not a permanent rejection. Remember that as we were reviewing these items, it was a fast-track supplemental bill. Some of the items were left off for consideration in the capital budget rather than included in the fast track. Now, to go, I'm not going to walk through the individual items, as I said, because what we did was then categorize the items, and I'll just walk through the categories. If you have any questions, please ask along the way.
If any member has any questions, do not hesitate to interrupt and ask Mr. Teal questions.
The first group here is the unallocated operating reductions. Those were all rejected, not because we didn't want to accept those reductions, but because it's an executive branch thing. The governor had already restricted those funds, and there was no reason to take legislative action for something that the executive branch had already done. That said, we did include the reductions as part of the savings in the bill, so there is some expectation that the unallocated reductions will be achieved by the executive branch, and those, because they are included in the savings lines in the fiscal summary. The next category is operating lapse extensions. These were temporarily removed from the supplemental bill put in front of the House Finance Committee. The reason for that was that lapse extensions typically don't get the scrutiny by the subcommittees that perhaps they deserve. So by putting them out in front of the full Finance Committee, the subcommittee chairs and others on finance were able to look at how lapse extensions would affect the 2010 operating budget. Some were accepted, some were rejected, some were withdrawn by OMB, and then they, where appropriate, went back into the supplemental bill. So you can see that most of those were accepted. The ones that weren't are on page 4, colored orange, and most of those were withdrawn by OMB. Some of them were incorporated into the operating budget. The next category is specific operating reductions. It starts on page 6. And I believe that all of those were taken except starting on page 11 with item number 61, and the item number is right to the left of the color-coded column. So there we have 5 items that are not included in the bill. Moving on to the operating requests, these are, generally speaking, requests for additional funding for 2009, and in many cases substituting federal funds for general funds in the case of the HNSS FMAP. They go on for a number of pages all the way through page 33, and as you can see, most of those were accepted. Capital items start on page 34. And in looking at capital items, most of these were reappropriations. And the theory on the reappropriations was, rather than look at a reappropriation as a single item where you're taking from one project and giving it to another, we split that choice and said, if this is a dead capital project that no longer needs the money, we will take it. But we won't necessarily put the money toward a project that was the other side of that appropriation. That's a separate decision. So the money was removed, in most cases put into the capital income fund rather than directed immediately to another project. And then in some cases, the capital income fund was used to fund some of the supplemental requests. So there is one error in this, because our intent was to take only statewide projects. None of them were supposed to be legislative add-ons, which were typically part of the normal capital budget reappropriation process. There is one project that was included in that scoop of dead projects. It's number 218 on page 35. It takes money from a capital project that was a legislative add-on, and I believe there's an amendment being prepared to the capital bill to fix that, and it'll also be fixed in a CS of this bill. Beyond that, all the capital projects that were identified as being finished or money no longer necessary, the money was removed from those capital projects, except for those projects where OMB submitted amendments reversing their original request. A few of those start on page 43, item 257, and hangs on into page 45. So skip the page here, because what we should be looking at next is beginning on page 34. We have the new capital projects. And as you can see, starting on page 34, there were a number of items included in the supplemental. And they go all the way through page 43, at which point we get into a few projects that were not accepted into the bill. Many of those were later included in the capital budget. So again, no legislative add-ons to this bill. They're all governor's requests. I don't know how many of the items of the governor's original request that were not included in the bill have come around as a second request to add them to the bill, as you hear it here in the Finance Committee.
Are there any questions at this time? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. David, on page 4, item 28, or correction, 26. Could you just talk us through that? And it appears to me that both in-state gas pipeline and a follow-on, a larger pipeline, are included in this appropriation language.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, this is a lapse extension, and it applies to gas line right-of-way applications. It does include ANGDA, NSTAR, Denali, TransCanada, and anybody else that might come along. It strictly gives DNR money to deal with right-of-way issues. There's money that will lapse on June 30th of this year without this lapse extension. So DNR says there's a need for the money. You have two choices on the item. You either extend the lapse, and there's about $2.9 million available, or you give a new 2010 appropriation. So, I think to answer your question, it's right of way for any gas company.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions of Mr. Teal? Seeing none, this bill will be coming up for consideration later on this week. With that, we'll take an at ease.
record, we're going to have an at ease for probably about 5 minutes. I want to take a 5 minute at ease. We're at ease. I'd like to bring the committee back to order. Thank everybody for being patient as we work through our schedule today. We have three labor items waiting: House Bill 199, appropriation on transportation stimulus, and we're going to move on to House Bill 134, cruise ship wastewater discharge permits. Finish up today with House Bill 26, Medicaid for adult dental services. We're going to go till 11 o'clock, and then we'll recess and pick up after that if we do not finish these three items. Next item up is House Bill 199, the appropriation non-transportation stimulus. This is the second hearing on this bill, although we've heard the Senate version four times. And this bill the House version was heard for the first time yesterday. The intent today is to bring the bill back on the table, do some amendments, and then see the will of the committee. I'd like to have Mr. Jesse Keel come forward, please. Identify himself and who he works for. And then if you could give us a kind of an overview of the bill for those that are home watching this that may not be as familiar with this particular important policy discussion as most of us in the room, and then we'll move on to some amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jesse Keel, staff to Senate District B and the Senate Finance Committee. The bill before the committee, the House Finance version of House Bill 199 as amended, appropriates the non-transportation funding made available to the state by what's called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, better known as the Federal Stimulus Bill. Walking briefly through the bill, you will see that Section 1 of the legislation makes appropriations for operating expenses of government and operating grants made to a number of school districts and boards and through state entities to nonprofits. These are in item one, in section one, Mr. Chairman. These are items that the governor, about which the governor initially had questions. They are items that this committee and its counterpart in the House looked at closely and over many days in hearings. And the bill before you, Mr. Chairman, accepts the funding for made available to schools, to domestic violence programs, and a number of other important public services in this operating section. You will see as you flip through the bill that Section 1 totals roughly $118 million in federal money. There's also made available in this section $40,000 of general funds to match federal funds for health information technology. Section 4 of the bill, Mr. Chairman, contains items that the governor had no reservations or qualms about taking, and the committee, as well as its counterpart in the other body, found itself, I believe, in agreement, Mr. Chairman, for capital projects and grants. These are for things that state government already does, Mr. Chairman, as for most of the operating items. Things like clean water and underground storage tanks, things like forestry and emergency shelter grants and low-income housing. As well, Mr. Chairman, there are some capital appropriations for things, especially in the University of Alaska, the University of Alaska's research vessel, which has been an issue at this table and before the legislature for many years. This appropriates federal receipt authority available through the Stimulus Act for that vessel. That section, Mr. Chairman, totals approximately $231 million in federal authority. Section 7 of the bill, Mr. Chairman, contains capital items and grants about which the administration was initially not, about which the administration initially did not make decisions. These include programs like the Community Development Block Grants, like grants that DEC may be able to make for cleaner air, especially through diesel emission reduction programs, some energy conservation, weatherization, state energy plan funds. Mr. Chairman, some of these, one of the items in Section 7 of the bill, specifically the DEC item, does require a piece of legislation. That legislation has passed the Senate, and I believe is, if memory serves, pending in the other body. Mr. Chairman, Section 10 of the bill begins on page 16. It is an uncommonly robust set of legislative intent statements. These were drafted by the other body, and taken together, the best summary of them, Mr. Chairman, would be that these state the legislature's clear belief that this is one-time money. It's not coming back. We're not replacing it. General funds will not be forthcoming. Spend it accordingly. Spend it wisely. And, Mr. Chairman, we have heard a great deal of testimony before this committee that that is what agencies and nonprofits and municipalities and school districts plan to do. There are additional language sections in the bill making appropriations. Mr. Chairman, the one that is perhaps of greatest note is a legislative addition at Section 11 of the bill on page 17. It does add $200,000 of general funds, Mr. Chairman. It appropriates those to the Department of Administration for oversight and accounting, for accountability. The federal stimulus law does a great deal, requires a great deal of accountability for the funds it appropriates. The federal government is already working very closely with the legislature's audit division, and we will be well served, Mr. Chairman, by carefully tracking every dollar. Section 12 of the bill, Mr. Chairman, allows the state to take additional federal Medicaid money should the match rate go up. Section 13 deals with some additional federal money available to the Department of Revenue for child support collection, and is the sort of program we have taken advantage of at the state of Alaska in the past. It is a highly efficient way to use federal money. That program was set to end and was temporarily extended by this stimulus act. We've done this before, Mr. Chairman. The bill intends to continue it. Section 14 of the bill may be the largest single chunk of money, Mr. Chairman, and I have no doubt we will discuss this in greater detail, but this is in two pieces. Section 14 appropriates what are known as the fiscal stabilization funds, which exist in two categories. The Part B money is appropriated paradoxically in Part A of this section. But it's $20.7 million, Mr. Chairman. The federal government gives tremendous flexibility in what the state can do with this, and this bill appropriates it to Alaska municipalities on a per capita basis for revenue sharing. The next subsection of this bill, Mr. Chairman, beginning on line 8 of page 19, appropriates the fiscal stabilization Part A funds, $93 million for education. Mr. Chairman, that in a nutshell is the committee substitute before you. I would say on a more qualitative basis, the bill does little or nothing. On a more qualitative basis, Mr. Chairman, the administration has expressed a very strong desire to ensure that stimulus money spent by the state or granted by the state is spent wisely, is spent on one-time items that improve the efficiency of government or improve future delivery of services without ongoing obligations, Mr. Chairman. In the vast majority of categories in this bill, the administration has a great deal of discretion. Perhaps the best example would be the domestic violence grants, Mr. Chairman. The state commission that will distribute those monies has an absolute majority of governors, commissioners on it. I have great faith that the governor will take great care with these funds and that they will be spent responsibly, that public services will be aided without ongoing obligations. Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to take additional questions. I understand it's your intention to take up proposed amendments at a later.
Right now.
Now, Mr. Chairman?
All right, so you don't have to go far.
Okay.
Unless there's preliminary questions from the committee members. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding the funds for education, the $93 million, is there specific language that we are going to be requiring the school districts to sign that says that they agree that this is one-time funding?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the federal stimulus law does not give the state the power to require such a signed document. If you'll take a look at the legislative intent sections, Mr. Chairman, they are quite strong and give the Department of Education and Early Development the instruction. If you'll page 16, line 27, Mr. Chairman, you will see that it's legislature's intent, the Department of Education do, in essence, everything it possibly can to make sure the districts understand and agree to precisely that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? We'll go ahead and work on some amendment work here. I'll go ahead and move amendment number one and object for discussion. Mr. Teal.
Mr. Chairman, your amendment number one looks small, but it settles a rather large question. It takes effect for those who may be watching or listening at home and don't have it in front of them. It takes effect on page 19, on line 11. It simply tightens the reference to the federal stimulus law under which the $93 million is distributed, Mr. Chairman, from the broad section 14002A, which describes all the potential uses of this pot of money, to a specific use, Mr. Chairman, 14002A3. Mr. Chairman, the newspapers this morning and some of the conversation in front of the committee have revealed a growing discussion and an increasingly lawyerly one over whether this pot of money, this $93 million, can be used in lieu of some of the dollars that the state intends to put into education funding, or whether it must be additional money to school districts. The brief description of that discussion, Mr. Chairman, might be that the federal stimulus law sort of has three doors you could walk through with this money. And the first one doesn't apply to Alaska. That says if you've cut your school spending, you can restore it. We didn't do that, Mr. Chairman. The legislature and the governor have increased school funding. Door number two, Mr. Chairman, says if you need this money to allow your formula increases that you already have in law, if you can't do it without this money, Mr. Chairman, you can use this $93 million. And there is some, has been some discussion as to whether the state of Alaska might qualify under this provision and save a buck. Mr. Chairman, your amendment number one sets the lawyerly debate aside in favor of a policy call. It says we'd prefer door number three, thank you. And door number three, Mr. Chairman, says that the state can distribute this money to two school districts as additional funds, using the same proportions as we used last year for a pot of federal money called Title I money, Mr. Chairman. That Title I refers to the Federal Education, or Elementary and Secondary Education Act. It's been around since before I was born. And it is a reasonably good way to distribute money statewide. Mr. Chairman, there is no provision in Alaska's education funding formula to offset Title I money. With the adoption of this amendment, these funds, these $93 million, will be distributed to school districts, and they will be additional monies.
Okay. Do we have any other questions on the amendment? Okay, I'll go ahead and remove my objection to amendment number one. Any further objection to amendment number one? Amendment number one is adopted. And I'll move on to amendment number two. Go ahead and move amendment number two and object for discussion. Mr. Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number two is one of those belt and suspenders amendments, Mr. Chairman. As you will note on page 7, line 26 of the bill before the committee, there is a $1 million appropriation of federal receipt authority for something of a catch-all. It's placed in the office of the governor, and it currently reads American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, statewide competitive, discretionary, and incentive grants. It's a placeholder, Mr. Chairman, as it currently reads, for grants in any of those categories that the state doesn't currently anticipate. Certainly, we don't know if we'll win any competitive grants. Should the state receive those monies, the office of the governor could approach the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee when the legislature is not in session for authority to expand this amount. There is a category that's not included, and this amendment takes care of it. Those would be entitlement funds, Mr. Chairman. And it was brought to my attention, Mr. Chairman, that perhaps we should make entitlement fund plural to avoid any confusion that there might be a federal entitlement fund. There isn't. This is meant to catch the broad category of entitlement funds. And Mr. Chairman, it applies most especially to transportation funding. The federal highway formula is an entitlement. In the event that we get additional money that counts as an entitlement rather than a competitive grant or discretionary grant or incentive grant, this would let us take it.
Okay. We'll go ahead and take that as a technical amendment to this amendment by adding an S to the end of fund. Do we have any further questions on the amendment? Go ahead and remove my objection to the amendment. Do we have any further objection on adoption of amendment number two? Seeing none, amendment number two is adopted. We'll move on now to the final amendment, amendment number three, and I'll go ahead and move amendment number three and object for discussion. Mr. Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment three is a little housekeeping and attention to detail. the legislature's primary guru on the stimulus funding and the multiple wizards of stimulus funding at the Office of Management and Budget have been doing remarkable work catching every single dollar. This amendment, Mr. Chairman, simply increases the appropriation of federal stimulus dollars for the Community Services Block Grant Program and the Community Development Block Grant Program by very small amounts to match up exactly with what we now expect to get from the federal government. In the case of one of those grants, it's an increase of $36, Mr. Chairman, but it doesn't pay to ignore the nickels and dimes. I apologize for the technical nature, or for the conceptual nature of this amendment. There was a miscommunication between myself and the Legislative Legal Services that on the amendment at line 7, it should insert $3,962,565, and the additional lines below that should be increased accordingly. There are no substantive changes with this amendment, Mr. Chairman. It simply updates the dollar amounts.
Do we have any questions on the amendment? Go ahead and remove my objection to amendment number 3. Do we have a further objection to adoption of amendment number 3? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and adopt amendment number 3. Takes care of our amendments. Thank you, Mr. McNeil.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'd like to go ahead and invite the OMB director to come forward, please. Ms. Rayfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Just hold it there for a minute. I think we'll back up for a minute on amendment number 3. We'll adopt amendment number 3 with permission to allow Ledge Legal to make conforming changes to their technical amendment. So they can make any objection to that. Okay. Go ahead and ask Ledge Legal to clean that up. Ms. Rayfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning.
Senator Thomas.
Could we have just a brief at ease?
Brief at ease. Back on the record, Ms. Rayfield, for the third time, I guess we'll finally we'll get you rolling here. You can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then speak to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Karen Rayfield with the Office of Management and Budget. Thank you for letting me come to the table this morning and speak just briefly about the bill. I do appreciate the amount of effort that both bodies have taken reviewing all of the components of the economic stimulus package. The work that you've done on the bill in bringing this forward has been appreciated, and I know will be helpful to the governor as she makes her decisions about the bill that ultimately passes. We do think it was important to bring forward these policy questions as just was identified by Mr. Keel. It is allowable under the law to utilize the stabilization funds for our school funding formula increases based on the timing and the statutory language of the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. but he is correct. It is a policy question. Given the current revenue shortfall, which was, of course, not the case when we passed the school funding bill, I think it was appropriate to bring these forward so that we could have the conversation about utilizing these funds to help us reduce the draw on reserves and extend the life of our savings, which has been a continued discussion by this committee and by the legislature and by the governor. So we do think those are appropriate recommendations to bring forward for your consideration, and we appreciate your willingness to discuss those. Clearly, in the bill that you have before you in the amendments today, you have chosen another policy decision, but it was something that we felt very strongly it was important to bring forward to you.
Thank you. And just for clarity, yesterday when we had the bill up, you know, the chairman here got a little reversed on the order, and I had Ms. Rayfield come forward. I should have actually had presentation on the bill from representatives from the House, and there was amendments that have been passed out, recommended amendments by the administration that we did review. We had them right before the meeting yesterday, and we reviewed them yesterday and this morning and decided not to come forward with them. And we're just like to apologize to Ms. Rayfield for getting a little out of order yesterday. I just, you know, for those that don't follow the meeting flow, it probably wasn't noticeable, but it would have been a little smoother if I didn't get out of order. And I would like to thank her for the amount of work and effort that she's done dealing with this stimulus and the interface that she's had with the legislative side, because it was a lot of additional work that isn't normally planned for in the legislative session this year. And to your staff that spent the many hours, and our staff that spent the very many hours working through these policy discussions so we could finish our legislative agenda on time this year.
Thank you.
Any final questions from the committee members? Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Finance Committee pass out CS Sprouse Bill 199 Finance amended as amended by the Senate Finance Committee with individual recommendations.
We have a motion to move the bill from committee with individual recommendations. Do we have objection? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and move the bill from committee and go to our next piece of labor. We're going to have a brief at ease while we hand out a CS. We're at ease. Go ahead and come back on the record today. We've got 25 minutes or so. We're going to 40 minutes. We're going to go ahead and take up House Bill 134, cruise ship wastewater discharge permits. This is the first hearing on the bill. The intent today is to introduce the committee substitute. We'll introduce the bill, then we're going to introduce the committee substitute, take some public testimony, and then we're going to set this bill aside. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Senate Finance Committee adopt Senate CS for CS for House Bill 134 Finance / D as our working document.
We have a motion to
The two different
adopt version D as our working document. We have objection.
Mm-hmm. Effective date.
Seeing none, version D. Version D is our working document. What I'd like is to have Representative Harris go ahead and walk us through the bill, and then we're going to have the commissioner touch bases on some of the changes.
Okay, thank you very much. For the record, my name is John Harris, representing District 12. The initial intent of this bill was real simple. It eliminated five words from the point of discharge from where the testing took place for discharge on these cruise ships. It's been modified slightly since then, and the last modification before this committee substitute came in Senate Resources. And the whole concept here is to give some certainty both to the Department of Environmental Conservation as well as to the industry and to those people out there in Alaska who are concerned about the quality of water that is being discharged from these ships into Alaska waters. So, Mr. Chairman, not to make this a very long, drawn-out deal, your committee substitute, I believe the commissioner will get into it more in depth, but what Resources tried to do was make a six-year sunset, which we didn't oppose the sunset. We understand, you have to try to put some definitive timetables on when you're asking people to comply. The problem was the way it was written, it really was a five-year sunset. So, Mr. Chairman, I know you've taken care of that to make it a six-year sunset. And also to allow the scientific panel to meet every 3 years in a six-year period rather than every two. So it basically is what the bill does. And Commissioner, I think you can probably take it from there.
If you can introduce yourself for the record and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members. My name is Larry Hartig. I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation and here to testify today on Senate CS for CS for HB 134 Finance. DEC appreciates the opportunity we've had over the last few weeks to work with Representative Harris and other members of both bodies on this bill. Clearly, everyone that's worked on this has been guided by the goal of maintaining Alaska clean water. With passage of the bill, DEC will be able to continue to protect Alaska waters while providing some temporary relief to cruise ships to meet the at-the-point-of-discharge requirement that was included in the voters' initiative passed several years ago. That at-the-point-of-discharge requirement requires the cruise ships to treat their waste or otherwise reduce the amount of pollutants in their waste before they discharge it so that they meet state water quality criteria at the point of discharge, in other words, as soon as it leaves the vessel. We had a technology conference in February, just several months ago, here in Juneau. DEC sponsored that to review the technologies that are out there currently that can treat waste from cruise ships. And what we learned from that conference is that there's not technologies at this point in time that would allow cruise ships to consistently meet that at the point of discharge requirement for all pollutants. They're doing a very good job. The quality of their effluent is pretty high, relative to other dischargers that are similarly situated, but they haven't quite achieved that goal of the initiative. And so what this bill does is allow them some relief, some additional time, an additional 6 years, Representative Harris mentioned, to achieve that goal. It also has interim steps to help move that along, help move them along towards that goal. These include DEC convening a science advisory panel of 11 experts. Those experts would work with DEC to review the records that the cruise ship companies would be giving us, on their efforts to achieve the standard. That we would convene a technology conference in before January 1, 2013, and another one perhaps by 2015, where we'd review the various technologies that are out there, what the cruise ship companies have been able to achieve in terms of water quality, what we think they might be able to achieve with some additional time, and what steps should be taken to try to get them there. After both technology conferences, we'd be producing a report to the legislature so you could track the progress. There would be a report that would come to you on or before January 1, 2013, you know, after the first technology conference, and another report by 2015. That date is chosen because we want to have at least a year period there before the sunset kicks in that gives, you know, that allows us to give relief to the cruise ships from that at the point of discharge requirement. We want to have a year in there so that the legislature can have time to digest, you know, the reports, the technology reports, review what the cruise ship companies have been able to achieve, take additional testimony, and decide whether that six-year date is still appropriate. Again, the technology conference that we convened last February said that they're not there yet. They're close, but not there quite for all parameters, all pollutants, in meeting that at the point of discharge requirement. We wish we did, but nobody has a crystal ball that tells them the exact date, much less a year, you know, that they're going to be able to achieve that standard. 6 years to DEC seems an appropriate time period. It could be less, hopefully not more, but certainly the other provisions of this bill will help move them as quickly as reasonable towards that goal. And if it's the pleasure of the chair, I'd be happy to walk through briefly the sections of the bill.
I'd like you to, yes.
Thank you. Again, the intent section in section one of the bill just again states the goal of the initiative is the goal of the legislature, and certainly I'd emphasize the goal of the administration to achieve the at the point of discharge requirements as soon as we can. Section two allows what has commonly been called the waiver provision from the at the point of discharge requirement. It says that the cruise ships are going to have to meet that at the point of discharge requirement except as provided in Section E below, the waiver provision, which I'll go through in a minute. Section 3 is basically the same as Section 2, except it eliminates that waiver provision. The idea is that Section 2 would become immediately effective on passage of this act. After the six-year sunset, then Section 3 would kick in and remove the waiver. Section 4 describes the waiver, you know, what the cruise ship companies would have to do to be entitled to the waiver. The conditions that it sets is that they must at least be employing the technology, the treatment measures that represent the most technologically effective and economically achievable technology in waste reduction. If DEC finds they're not doing that, they would not be entitled to the waiver. It also includes a provision that the waiver can only be granted for no more than 3 years at a time. What this means is that with a six-year sunset, DEC would be issuing a new permit if HB 134 passes in the spring of 2010, and then that permit would be good for the cruise seasons 2010, 2011, 2013. We'd have the technology conference before issuing the next 3 year permit. We'd look, review, you know, the information from that technology conference, our experience of the last 3 years, including the additional measures to tighten down the standard based on what technology has been able to achieve at that date when we reissue the permit for the 2013, 2014, and 2015 seasons. So that's the Section E again, that they have to at least achieve what technology can allow them to achieve. And then that's just for a three-year period, that permit. F is similar to E. F just describes how DEC sets the limit. It just says that the permit limit that we set, it has to be based on that most technologically effective, economically feasible technology. Section G is what we call an anti-backsliding provision. What this says is that if we include a limit in that first permit that we issue that's based on the best technology available at that time, and we come in 3 years later to reissue or issue a new permit, we cannot set a standard that's any less rigorous than the permit we set earlier. And this provision doesn't sunset, it continues. So what it means is technology advances and we issue permits, you know, to the cruise ships. They'll have to keep up with that technology. They can't backslide. As technology advances, the limits will get tighter and tighter. Section H This just reiterates that nothing in the bill precludes us from adding other conditions as DEC sees necessary to protect the waters of the state. Specifically, what it has in mind is that we're aware that during this interim period, if they're not able to achieve at the point of discharge requirements for all parameters, there's other conditions we can put in the permit that would lessen the risk that there would be any concentration that would be in the receiving water that could be harmful to organisms in the environment. For instance, we could require ships to only discharge in certain areas. We could avoid, you know, certain sensitive, environmentally sensitive areas. They wouldn't be able to discharge there. We could also require that they be going at least 6 knots before they discharge. And we've had other studies that we've done in conjunction with EPA that show that when the vessels are traveling at 6 knots, you have a 50,000 dilution factor. So basically instantaneous dilution, where even though the effluent may not achieve water quality criteria at the end of pipe, as soon as it hits the water, it gets quickly mixed behind the vessel, it would achieve that standard so that you wouldn't have a concentration that anything would be exposed to that would be harmful. But we could add those as additional provisions, you know, in any permit that we write. Section 5 is the science advisory panel that I described earlier. We've had success with such panels in the past. In fact, several years ago when we were doing a dilution study, we had a science panel that assisted the department in that effort. Their requirements are simply that the people have have expertise in the area, and then it also provides in Section 5 that we have some representatives on from various interested groups, particularly coastal communities that may have an interest on land treatment systems that could be employed by vessels, people from at least one person from the cruise ship industry, one person from commercial fishing industry, and one from non-government organizations with an interest in water quality matters. Section B under or subsection B under Section 5 describes the reports that I mentioned earlier. There would be a report to the legislature from DEC with input from the science panel that would be given to you before January 1, 2013. This would allow you again to see where we're at before we issue the new permit for the next three cruise seasons, to see if you think there's any adjustments that need to be made at that point. And then there would be a final report in 2015. The idea there being, again, that if the cruise ship companies have been able to achieve at the point of discharge requirement, you know, everything is good, the sunset provision would kick in, everything would be fine. If they have gotten yet closer but still haven't gotten all the way, you would have enough time a year before that last three-year permit would expire to take action. We wouldn't go right up to the cliff before a decision, you know, from the legislature could be made. The sunset provisions are contained in Section 7 and 8. Section 8 just provides that Section 3 and 7 take effect December 31, 2015. Those are the sections, again, the waiver section that does the section that doesn't have the waiver provision in it. And Section 7 says the Section E that does have the waiver would be repealed. Section F, which sets the standard that would be issued under, that would use a setting a water quality standard under the waiver, and 464 would be the a special reporting requirement that the cruise ship companies would be under during this 6-year period. All those would go away on December 31, 2015, and we'd be back at the point of discharge requirement.
Do we have any initial questions before we take an amendment? Seeing none, Senator Ellis.
Senator, staff has an amendment to distribute, or I'm not sure if members have it yet.
It's been distributed.
It has. Okay. I move the amendment.
I'll object.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendment was originally drafted to the resources CS, but our staffs have checked it out, and it does technically comport and is accurate for the finance CS. So just wanted to make that clear. This amendment makes small but important wording changes to the bill, and I'd like to explain. The current language in the bill requires DEC to impose cruise ship wastewater technologies that are both the most technologically effective and economically feasible. In some cases, a technology can't be both the best and economically feasible. So the amendment requires use of the most effective technologies that are also economically feasible. So that's the change. My understanding is that the bill sponsor is supportive of this language. It's also my understanding that DEC has signed off, and I would further, well, I would quote Lynn Kent, Director of the Division of Water, these changes will work and solve the problem. So that's the heart of the amendment.
And bill sponsor and the department's comfortable?
No objection.
Yeah, fine.
Any other questions on the amendment? I'll go ahead and remove my objection to the amendment. We have further objection to adoption of amendment number one. Seeing none, we'll go ahead and adopt amendment number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any questions of the bill sponsor of the department before we take public testimony? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we look at this bill here, one of the questions I have is, in any part of the effluent, whether it's gray water, treated sewage, or otherwise, is there any infective particles that might be within this water, within this discharge?
Infective?
Yeah.
Doctor, what do you mean?
Well, as you look down at some of the particles that are out there, whether they're actually living viruses or bacteria, I'm sure are neutralized by this. But and you even go down lower than that, where you start to deal with things like prions. Do you know anything about, is that involved here, or are they being discharged freely into the water?
Senator Olson, through the chair, I'm going to turn that over to the commissioner. He's probably going to turn it over to his water specialist, so I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, my real question is, if somebody happens to be swimming behind it for some reason, can they get sick?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, when one of the cruise ship companies applies for the permit, they would have to characterize what's in their waste, and the DEC then reviews that, and if we think is accurate, then what we would do is we would go through and compare that with state water quality standards, and those standards include provisions to protect human health. And then what we would do is, if we saw something in there that would not meet that standard, then might not meet the standard, even there was a risk that they might not meet the standard, what we do is we set a permit limit or other conditions that would either preclude or limit the discharge of that particular pollutant. And so if you look at the permit for a cruise ship, just as any other permittee, you would see that there's various pollutants that are listed, and then there's limits for those, or there might even be prohibitions. And the ones that we're really addressing here that the cruise ship companies have not been able to achieve consistently, those are ammonia, copper, nickel, and zinc. Those are the ones that we've been talking about.
My last question, Mr. Chairman, has to do with, is there any reference, does this deal with ballast water at all?
Ballast water?
Yes.
Senator Olson, through the chair, I don't believe it does. It deals with all the discharge that comes off the ship, but I don't know that these cruise ships, I'm not sure that they how much ballast they deal with. Mr. Commissioner, do you know the answer to that?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, no, this does not address ballast water.
Thank you, sir.
Any other questions? Okay, we'll go ahead and move on now then to public testimony. For those watching at home, we've had presentations here a month or so ago on the discharge issue in the report that was produced. So this is, although this is the first hearing on this bill, it's not the first hearing on the subject matter. Chip Thoma. You got, if you could make some comments, identify yourself.
Yes, sir.
Represent and then speak to the bill and try to keep your comments succinct because the clock is ticking and the bells are gonna ring.
I'll be very brief. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Chip Thoma. I'm the president of the Responsible Cruising in Alaska. And we've been very active in this bill, its progress through the legislature, HB 134. My two comments, first answer one of the questions that Senator Olson asked. I don't know about the infective particles involved in the discharge. I do know from talking to commercial fishermen, they are very concerned about the caustic nature of the discharges. They instruct their crewmen to always wear gloves when they're in areas that cruise ships are discharging in. I was told by a lobbyist friend who's also a commercial fisherman from Petersburg that the soap and the other products that get discharged in Frederick Sound, for instance, are extremely caustic, and he's very concerned about that and always has been. So just to address that part, as far as the sunset goes, my understanding is that we were going to have a six-year sunset based on the year 2009. We're going to a seven-year sunset now based on the basically a six-year based on the year 2010. That's a total of 9 years from the time that the initiative was passed. We gave 20 years, as you probably are aware, on a federal level for double hull tankers. We're giving 9 years for these cruise ships to come into water quality standards. I should note for the record that the two problem lines, Princess Line and Holland America Line, have serious problems with their piping on board their ships. They're making soft water. 60% of the water that's generated on board the ships is soft water. It is corroding the copper and the galvanized pipes on board the ships. That is contributing significantly to the copper and the zinc levels on board these ships. These two lines are specifically the ones that are having problems. The other cruise ships that are operating in Alaska are very, very close to achieving full water quality standards as defined by the 2010 limits. So far, only Princess and Holland America have refused to change out their pipes, and that is the stem, I believe, the stem root of their problem. So, Mr. Chairman, in summary, I do support 134. I wish that we had a shorter sunset year by 1 year. I think we could go to a 3 and a 2 year permit very easily and give these cruise ships the notice on that last 2 year permit that this will be over in 2015, January of 2015. So that's my testimony, and I appreciate your time, Mr. Chairman. Okay,
thank you for your testimony today. Next up, Joe Geldhoff. You can identify yourself and who you represent.
Thank you,
Bill. And I did misspeak earlier. The floor session is 1 o'clock today instead of 11.
But, well, in any event.
But that doesn't mean talk.
I shouldn't go on. Mr. Chairman, my name is Joe Geldhoff. My address is 2 Marine Way, Suite 207. I'm here representing myself. And I'm here because I was one of the principal authors of the initiative that became law in 2006. This bill is interesting to me because it proves that Alaskans and representatives from industry and fishing groups and from a wide spectrum of constituents and user groups can and have worked together to get an acceptable piece of legislation. Too often in this building it is said that we Alaskans don't know how to work together and we pit industry versus the environment and a variety of other things. And this is an example where we have worked together to craft a compromise. From the perspective of a lot of marine users, recreation users, people in the fishing community, this bill started out as an F. And as it's worked through, and in large part because of the leadership of Representative Harris, it's become quite a good bill. And one that I think is acceptable to industry. I will just sum up by saying Representative Harris acknowledged that there were other issues besides what was in play when this bill was initially started. The industry had varying perspectives, but in the end, the representatives from Princess, in particular, and Royal Caribbean acted in a very mature and measured way to craft a compromise. And there was a lot of hue and cry, a lot of positions taken by people, but I urge you to pass this. The sunset provision may be a little long, but it's not so long. In the end, everybody needs finality. And appreciate your getting this in the final form and final shape to move through the legislature so we can stop fighting about this for at least 5 or 6 years. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony today. We're now going to go to the off-net. Bruce Bustamante, if you can identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill, please, and try to keep your comments to a couple minutes.
I will do the best I can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bruce Bustamante, and I'm the Vice President of Community and Public Affairs for Princess Cruises and Tours, based out of Anchorage. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm going to testify in favor of House Bill 134. And also equally important, I want to thank Representative Harris for taking the lead on this legislation, which is very important for our industry, and he put in a lot of time in getting support on this particular bill. And, you know, as the bill moved through the legislature, it's been a lot of changes made to it from the original document. And it's not perfect from our standpoint, but as Commissioner Hartig mentioned earlier, it does give us more time to work on this issue, and it does give us more time that we want to work with ADEC and the science panel on this particular area. You know, the point of discharge component we've always believed has been unfair for us in that no other discharger is expected to meet water quality standards at point of discharge. And that part doesn't change from our standpoint, but with all of that said, you know, we can work with this, and I'd ask that you support, that you accept the committee substitute and you pass this particular bill out of the committee. But also I'd like to come back and answer a question. There was an accusation made about Princess Cruises and Holland refusing to replace piping. That's certainly not true. Those allegations come back to points of Princess having older ships, and that's not true either. Our ships average about 5 to 6 years old that we have in the Alaska trade. And from our water manufacturing components on board the ship, I mean, that water passes through stainless steel piping, not copper piping. But still, with that, with all of that said, as I mentioned before, I'm speaking in favor of House Bill 134 and ask that you pass this bill out of your committee. And again, thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Okay, thank you for testifying today. We're going to go now to Cordova. Jennifer Gibbons, if you can identify yourself and who you represent.
Good morning. Bill, thank you very much to Chair Stedman and the committee for the opportunity to testify. And I also am speaking in support of this bill. And I've participated all along the way. And as everyone has said, it's been a long process, a lot of give and take. And we're finally in a position where we've got a good compromise. And I'm the executive director of Prince William Soundkeeper, so I'm certainly looking at this from an environmental perspective, but I'm also the president of the Cordova Chamber of Commerce Board. So I see this issue also from a tourism perspective. And I think we've done a good job of providing reasonable and generous flexibility for the cruise industry to meet these standards. And I think that's very appropriate. And I'm very pleased to see that we also have a deadline for compliance here, because the other side of the equation is protection of Alaska waters. And, you know, every day I encounter fishermen in particular who are concerned with this issue. And, you know, the sidewalks, the restaurants, the telephones, the emails, they're everywhere. And they've been very, very concerned about this issue. And so I'm very pleased that everyone has crafted what seems a very fair and generous timeline for industry to comply, and yet we still have a deadline. So thank you very much for your work, and thank you to Representative Harris. I know it's been a challenge working with all of our unique personalities.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony today. That concludes our off-net, on-net, and folks that have signed up. Well, we have Representative Harris. Did he leave? Mr. Bitney, your point man. You can introduce yourself for the record, who you represent.
Mr. Chairman, members of Senate Finance Committee, my name is John Bitney. I'm an aide to Representative Harris, who's been working on this bill, and we have another bill that he's addressing down in the other committee at the other end of the hall at the moment, but I can answer any questions if you'd like.
We're going to find out if we have any here. Do we have any final questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for further consideration at another time. Now we're going to take up the last. We'll have a brief at ease. And now work on our last piece of labor, House Bill 26, Medicaid for Adult Dental Services. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent is to introduce the bill today, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further consideration. And with us today is the bill representative from the bill sponsor. And if she could go ahead and introduce herself and who she works for, and speak to the bill, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Finance Committee. My name is Julie Lucky, and I work for Representative Mike Hawker from District 32. Today you have House Bill 26 ahead of you. It basically extends work that we did a little while ago with, I think, House Bill 105. And what Representative Hawker likes to say is we went from the barbaric acute infection and pain threshold for allowing Medicaid recipients to get dental care to a better, more preventive approach. That's basically, in a nutshell, what the bill does. I'd be happy to answer questions. We also have some folks from the department that can talk about how the program works or what the money is being used for, whichever the committee desires.
So you'd prefer the department explain it, or do you want to tackle it? We should talk about the bill a little bit.
Okay, certainly, Mr. Chairman. I think the department would probably be better to explain what they actually cover. I can tell you that before we used to cover only when there was pain and infection, so you had to have had, we didn't cover any preventive care. You had to basically be in the state where you would have to have your teeth pulled. We didn't cover any of the restorative care, such as fillings or root canals. The current program does cover the preventive care, root canals and fillings, and also dentures. And I think that the department may be better giving you more specifics.
We have a representative from the department that volunteers.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Brad Whistler. I'm dental officer for Department of Health and Social Services. What Julie described is pretty much accurate. Under the enhanced services that were authorized by this legislation, it covers routine dental visits, routine restoratives or fillings. It covers denture services. It covers periodontal maintenance and root canal therapy, as was mentioned.
And it looks like we might need an amendment here to add an addition of a tie for the Senate Finance. Senator Hoffman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My question is are Alaska Natives that get services through Indian Health Services eligible? Are those entities eligible for payment for those services that they perform under this legislation?
Through the chairs, Senator Hoffman, yes, Indian Health Service tribal entities are eligible for Medicaid payment so long as the individuals are enrolled in Medicaid.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Do we have any questions for the department? Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You all made mention of the of dentures. I seem to remember a low-income senior citizen constituent coming to my office in great distress and very emotional, having been told by the department, and I may be mixing up programs, but he seems to have been told by the department that he had to pick between his uppers or his lowers, that he could not have a full set of dentures under Medicaid, and he was distraught and was thinking of, you know, not going on with life or moving to another state who was more humane in that regard. Can you spell it out, what the policy would be on dentures under your program?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis. One of the fiscal constraints that was set in this program is an annual limit per recipient. The level of that is $1,150. That's enough to cover an upper or lower denture. What was informed in terms of recipients on this is if it's timed, particularly this time of the year, you could get an upper denture in one fiscal year. You then would have a new limit for the next fiscal year, and you'd be able to get the lower denture. It was one of the compromises in terms of at what level to set the annual limit for these services.
Any other questions? We'll go Senator Olson, then we'll go across the table to Senator Thomas.
As you look at these limits, what happens if you have an emergency on your hand where somebody has an abscess that's going on, and obviously somebody can get septic from that, and then you could have further loss or some detrimental dental problems later on and could even be fatal? What do you do in that case?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, in terms of the previous level of services for treatment of pain and acute infection, things like dealing with an abscess or if a tooth had to be extracted, that's not part of the annual limit. So those are not subject to those physical constraints of the annual limit that I mentioned. That would be for the new services such as routine fillings or the denture services.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At least one of the papers here, one of the descriptions of what takes place, it mentions that missed appointments are a primary complaint among dentists, and we did talk with the dentist some over this current session, and that is not only a continuing but a worsening problem affecting how many dentists will actually take Medicaid patients. And is there any attempt to have some effect on that, you know, remediate that situation in some way or not?
Through the chair, Senator Thomas. The department has met with the Alaska Dental Society now on three occasions over the last year to look at dental issues with the Medicaid program. On this particular issue on missed or non-kept appointments, what we are looking at as a first step is to set up a way to have voluntary reporting from the dentist when a client misses a dental appointment, and then use the Medicaid Management Information System to start tracking those that repeatedly miss appointments, and then it would be up for discussion what the next step would be in those cases. But with where we're at right now, there's sort of varying perspectives on the level of extent of this problem. So as a first step, we're looking at a way to set it up so that we could start tracking the extent of the problem.
And if I could
follow up?
Just as you consider that, I realize that people may make several appointments, you know, call several dentists trying to, you know, get the earliest appointment they can, and it would seem that it would be a courtesy and that there could be something included in the paperwork that indicates that not only is it a problem, but you're going to take some action on it, and it could potentially be a negative for the individual seeking the treatment. Thank you.
Are there questions for the department? We have two people on the sign-up sheet, neither one of which is here. I don't think. Marie Darlin. You know, all know Marie. I don't. And Brad Whistler, is that?
Mr. Sherman, that's who was.
He's back there.
You can come forward.
Is that? Oh, I got the wrong guy, sorry. Paid more attention to my note. With that, is there any final questions for the bill sponsor?
Mr. Chairman, if I might just
go ahead.
A little bit of clarification about the caps. We're not actually changing that in this particular bill, Senator Ellis, through the chair. That was put up in the, there has been some discussion about that. That was put up in the original bill in order to get the compromise to get it past some of the members of the other body. I think that at the time they had discussed doing one set of dentures, that was kind of where the threshold was set, because it was an expansion in Medicaid and they wanted to make sure that it wasn't going to balloon out of control. There are people that think that since this program has only been in place a couple of years, that they'd like to see it go a couple more years prior to changing that cap, since right now it does still meet the goal of setting in one set of dentures, either uppers or lowers, but that was the policy call made at the time, was to only cover half. Just so that you understand the background of where that came from.
Okay, we have one fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services reflecting 2,529,700 GF to secure 4.7558 million in federal receipts. The funding for the GF match and physical note is included in the FY10 operating budget. And with that, seeing no further questions, call-ins, or public comment, we'll go ahead and set this bill aside for a future date. And that concludes our labor today. Our next meeting April 16th, 9 a.m. We'll be working on the schedule later today and post it so everybody knows what's coming. Meeting adjourned.